Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next half-hour segment, we're going to review a number of different stories, not necessarily connected with one another. Some of these are things that we've spoken about before, and some of these are things that I'm going to be introducing for the first time. Let me wake members of the audience up, those of you who might be feeling somewhat lethargic, by reading an eye-opening column which undoubtedly bestirred a lot of people who might have been sort of sleepy on the morning of Tuesday, July 6th, in Los Angeles. In the Los Angeles Times, and specifically on the op-ed page of the LA Times on that date, namely Tuesday, July 6th of 1999, Alexander Coburn had an op-ed column misleadingly titled by the L.A. Times, "We're Reaping Tragic Legacy from Drugs." From government LSD, subtitled, by the way, "From Government LSD Experiments to Overuse of Drugs Like Ritalin, the consequences are overwhelming." They are indeed, but this is really about far more than just the misprescription of drugs. One of the more startling aspects of this particular article is the revelation that Theodore Kaczynski, who was convicted as the Unabomber, had volunteered to participate in a psychological experiment, unquote, that administered as part of the CIA research into mind control that was going on from the end of World War II. Specifically, the fellow who experimented on him and presumably recruited him was a guy named a fellow named Dr. Henry Murray, who passed away in 1980. The Coburn column reads, "It turns out that Theodore Kaczynski, a.k.a. the Unabomber, was a volunteer in mind control experiments sponsored by the CIA at Harvard in the late 1950s and early 1960s. Michael Mello, author of the recently published book The United States of America versus Theodore John Kaczynski, unquote, notes that at some point in his Harvard years, 1958 to 1962, Kaczynski agreed to be the subject of a, quote, psychological experiment, unquote. Mello identifies the chief researcher for these only as a lieutenant colonel in World War II, working for the CIA's predecessor organization, the Office of Strategic Services. In fact, the man experimenting on the young Kaczynski was Dr. Henry Murray, who died in 1988. Murray became preoccupied by psychoanalysis in the 1920s, drawn to it through a fascination with Herman Melville's Moby Dick, which he gave to Sigmund Freud, who duly made the excited diagnosis that the whale was a father figure. After spending the 1930s developing personality theory, Murray was recruited to the OSS at the start of the war, applying his theories to the selection of agents and also presumably to interrogation. As chairman of the Department of Social Relations at Harvard, Murray zealously prosecuted the CIA's efforts to carry forward experiments in mind control conducted by Nazi doctors in the concentration camps. The overall program was under the control of the late Sidney Gottlieb, head of the CIA's Technical Services Division. Just as Harvard students were fed doses of LSD, psilocybin, and other potions, so too were prisoners and many unwitting guinea pigs. Sometimes the results were disastrous. A dram of LSD fed by Gottlieb himself to an unwitting U.S. Army officer, Frank Olson, plunged Olson into escalating psychotic episodes, which culminated in Olson's fatal descent from an upper window in the Statler Hilton in New York. Gottlieb was the object of a lawsuit not only by Olson's children, but also by the sister of another man, Stanley Milton Glickman, whose life had disintegrated into psychosis after being unwittingly given a dose of LSD by Gottlieb. What did Murray give Kaczynski? Did the experiment's long-term effects help tilt him into the Unabomber's homicidal rampages? The CIA's mind experiment program was vast. How many other human time bombs were thus primed? How many of them have exploded? And the rest of the column deals with the prescription of antidepressant drugs such as Prozac and Ritalin to kids, which is an interesting and important issue. But let's pause and rather than get into that at this time, I think that the revelation that apparently in some capacity Theodore Kaczynski had participated in some of the CIA mind control experimentation at Harvard, I think suggests the question, which Coburn obviously asked, to what extent that might have influenced his subsequent behavior. We've discussed mind control and specifically the CIA and military's mind control programs at considerable length in numerous archive shows, including RFA programs 5, 6, and 7, also a miscellaneous program about Jonestown, and we also have some information about mind control in a discussion of the Stockton Schoolyard shooting in January of 1989. That was sort of a prototype event in an analysis of that called Purdy's Last Stand, talking about the shooting spree by Patrick Edward Purdy. I discussed the fact that he not only had been apparently a member of various white supremacist groups and had Aryan Nations literature in his possession at the time of an earlier arrest, he also had worked for the Moonies, obviously an intelligence-connected cult, which engages in mind control. Whether that had anything to do with Patrick Purdy going off is another question. We've seen the school shootings become something of a pattern, and I think that Coburn has asked a very important question, and one that I ask, obviously, to what extent was that experimentation? How extensive was that experimentation? To what extent did that influence Kaczynski as the Unabomber? I suspect that there were more people involved than just Kaczynski. And in past discussions, both with listeners and in analysis of the Unabomber case, I've ventured the possibility that Kaczynski might have been under mind control in one capacity or another. Now, the fact that he participated in mind control experimentation 30-odd or almost 40 years ago does not necessarily mean he was under mind control, but it might, and I certainly think that's a possibility that needs to be carefully considered. Turning to Europe, research credit on the following goes to Dave White. As I speak on July 11th of 1999, when this is being recorded, we are seeing a great many reports coming out of Yugoslavia and Kosovo of alleged massacres. And I certainly do not in any way excuse excesses by the Serbs against the Kosovars. As I've indicated in the lengthy discussions that we've had in the past about the Balkans War, I do not excuse any atrocities committed by the Serbs, but those atrocities have been greatly exaggerated, and the Serbs are not the aggressors in this war, but rather they are the victims, and they've been the focal point of an ongoing destabilization program by the larger powers, in particular the United States and Germany, since the late 1980s. Again, lest I be misunderstood as sanctioning butchery, I do not sanction any atrocities committed by the Serbs. However, a savvy examination of the history of the Balkans War suggests that their atrocities have been greatly exaggerated and crimes against them have been downplayed or not discussed at all. In For the Record segment 148 called Truth Dash to Earth, For the Record segments 148, Truth Dash to Earth, I discussed the unreliability of war news in the year of our Lord 1999, when a great deal of political pressure can be brought to eliminate the truth concerning what is actually taking place in wars. That's not a new phenomenon, but it's one that's growing, at least here in the United States. In For the Record segments 148, we took a look at an alleged concentration camp that was being run or supposedly run in Bosnia for Bosnian Muslims. Turned out it wasn't a concentration camp at all, but it was merely photographers standing inside of a barbed wire enclosure, and not photographers, but television cameramen, and recording footage of Bosnian Muslims who were standing outside of the barbed wire enclosure looking in at them. But the world misunderstood this as proof of Serbian atrocities and the proof of a Serbian concentration camp, when in fact it was no such thing. As terrible as much of the suffering in Kosovo has been, I think that an intelligent political observer should be very careful about taking many of the anecdotal stories that we're getting at face value, because many journalists have not been careful in that regard. Again, the research credit on the following goes to Dave White. London Review of Books of May 27th of 1999 had the following story by Audrey Gillan, G-I-L-L-A-N, and that story is entitled, appropriately enough, What's the Story? Subtitled, Audrey Gillan Tries to Find the Evidence for Mass Atrocities in Kosovo. Again, the reference, London Review of Books, 527-99, researched for us by Dave White. It reads in part as follows. By the way, I may very well be mispronouncing some of these Kosovar and Slavic names. Fertezi Nimari, N-I-M-A-R-I, had lost two of her brothers, and her husband was forced to bury all the dead in one grave. Later, packed into a stifling bus with 60 fellow Kosovars, the couple held on to each other as he clutched a strap suspended from the ceiling. The bus stopped in the Stankovic 1 refugee camp in Macedonia, and they told their story. Quote, "The tank came to our village of Silovi, S-L-O-V-I. The Serb neighbors said not to worry, it was just there to observe us. But by lunchtime the next day, a teenage girl lay dead in the street. Then another 15 people were killed. They told us to run into the woods, and they started shooting us," unquote. I asked them so many questions about what they had seen. What happened when your brothers were shot? How many people did you bury? How do you feel now? Unquote. When they said the Serbs had forced an old woman into a tent and burned her alive, I looked at them doubtfully and asked how they knew she had been alive. Someone from her family had seen it happen, they said. The Nemaris had arrived at what they thought was a safe haven, but I pursued them and I did so unsparingly. I got on the bus when the driver opened the doors for air. They had stood for hours on that malodorous bus, and I felt sorry for them, but not so sorry that I stopped the questions. They had yet to step down to the misery of camp that the British press had taken to calling Brajda. All they had was a bottle of water passed to them from an open window and my questions. Fertaji, 8 months pregnant, caught me glancing at the watch on her wrist when Remzi, her husband, said all the women in the village had been robbed of their jewelry. Earlier that day, Ron Redmond, the baseball-capped spokesman for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, stood at the Blace border crossing from Kosovo into Macedonia and said there were new reports of mass rapes and killings from three villages in the Liplan area, Slovi, Halak Evogel, and Ribari Evogel. He spoke to the press of bodies being desecrated, eyes being shot out. The way he talked, it sounded as if there had been at least 100 murders and dozens of rapes. When I pressed him on the rapes, asking him to be more precise, he reduced it a bit and said he had heard that 5 or 6 teenage girls had been raped and murdered. He had not spoken to any witnesses. Quote, "We have no way of verifying these reports of rape," he conceded. "These are among the first that we have heard of at this border." Unquote. Other UNHCR officials later told stories of women being tied to the walls of their houses and burned. 24 bodies buried in Kosovo Polje. Another report, again from Slovi, put the dead at 100. Mr. and Mrs. Nemari were adamant that it was 16. Truth could be scarce at the Blace border and in the camps dotted around Macedonia, but you are not allowed to say that during a war like this, where it may be that bad things are being done on both sides, just as you are not allowed to doubt atrocity. It's as if NATO and its entourage were trying to make up for the witlessness of the past, trying to show that whatever we do, we won't be turning a blind eye. But the simple-minded reporter in me wants to ask a question. Is there any real evidence for what is being said? In Macedonia, listening to the stories and the UNHCR accounts, you would find it hard to tell what was hearsay and what was fact. When you looked at the people clinging onto the carrier bags that now held the remnants of their lives, it seemed evident that terrible things had happened to them, that people had been forced to flee their homes and drag themselves to a non-life in another country. Each person arriving at the camps had experienced some kind of trauma, and most are still living it. Many have seen death and other horrors. It is just that there is little to suggest that they have seen it in the ways and on the scale that people want to say they have. Most of those who have seen the killing have seen one or two shot and the bodies of others. Eyewitnesses to multiple atrocities are very rare, and the simple and not at all simple truth is that it can often be hard to establish the veracity of the information. One afternoon, the people in charge said there were refugees arriving who talked of 60 or more being killed in one village, 50 in another, but I could not find one eyewitness who actually saw these things happening. Now, they may have happened, but what we have is a situation where Western journalists accept details without question. Almost every day, the world's media, jostling for stories in Macedonia, strain to find figures that may well not exist. In the absence of any testimony, many just report what some agency or another has told them. I stood by as a reporter from BBC World reeled off what Ron Redmond had said, using the words hundreds, rape, and murder in the same breath. By way of qualification, a fairly meaningless one in the circumstances, he added that the stories had yet to be substantiated. Why, then, had he reported them so keenly in the first place? Skipping down. The officers from ICTY, the verifiers from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, and researchers from Human Rights Watch are compiling reports of war crimes, which will be used at a later date for any trial at The Hague. Speaking to these people, I found them to be wary of using the hyperbole favored by reporters and by the UNHCR. They say they have yet to see evidence of atrocities on the scale that they witnessed while working in Bosnia. When I went to see Benedikt Javer, G-I-A-E-V-E-R, the coordinator for OSCE's field office in Skopje, I saw that she was angered by the behavior of the media. Skipping down again. The things you come to know as a journalist do not march in a single file. Facts are often renegade. But among the rape victims arriving in Macedonia, nobody spoke of anything like the camps the British Foreign Secretary referred to. Benedict Yavé told me there had been rape, but not systematic and not on a grand scale. The same was true of the killing. "We don't have big numbers," she said. "What we have are consistent small numbers, 2 here, 5 there, 10 here, 7 there. Unlike the media and the UNHCR, the OSCE works in a slow, methodical way, waiting a few days till the refugees have settled in before they begin to ask questions. Quote, "These people have just arrived, and I would say they are still under a lot of stress and tension," unquote, Gave says, again quoting, "In that situation, 5 people can easily turn into 75. It's not that they want to lie, but often they are confused. It's not to say that it didn't happen, but a story could have moved around from village to village, and everyone from that village tells it as if it happened to them," unquote. Another senior OSCE source spoke even more clearly than any of us were inclined to do. He told me he suspected that the Kosovo Liberation Army had been persuading people to talk in bigger numbers to crank up the horror so that NATO might be persuaded to send ground troops in faster. Robin Cook's rape camp was the same thing, he said, an attempt to get the British public behind the bombing. And wasn't all this a lesson in how propaganda works in modern war? Amen to that, by the way. Continuing, "When I came back to London, I went to see the KLA spokesman and recruiting office in Golders Green, Dr. Plurat Sejdiu, S-E-J-D-I-U, sitting beside the KLA flag, and bust of the Albanian national hero Skanderbeg, said there were indeed rape camps, and that the evidence of mass atrocities was to be found among the refugees in Albania, not in Macedonia. He is in daily contact with the KLA frontline command by satellite phone, and has been told of rape camps in Glazkova, Rakovics, Suhareka, Prizren, and Skenderaj. Quote, "We know there are concentration camps, and women are kept and raped there," he said, again quoting, "I don't think we will get the evidence until we go in with ground troops. There are a lot of stories confirming it. There are mass executions, and mass graves are appearing now. We have reports from our special units moving around Kosovo. And the pertinent question is, where are the young men who have been taken from the refugee columns? I think everything will be proved when NATO troops go in." In Skopje, I had been to see Ben... Oh, by the way, that's unquote. I was quoting this fellow, Dr. Plurat, P-L-E-U-R-A-T, Sejdiu, who is the spokesperson for the KLA in England, in the United Kingdom. Continuing, "In Skopje, I had been to see Ben Ward, a researcher for Human Rights Watch. In the flat he is renting, he had found the Hotel Continental too expensive and the behavior of the reporters too disconcerting. He pored over maps of Kosovo and pointed to villages where he knows incidents have taken place. His information comes from eyewitnesses and is corroborated by the testimony of others. He has noted a very definite scorched earth policy. But while his latest report details killings and the mutilation of corpses in the villages of Bajnica and Chakaj, he doesn't think there is evidence of mass executions. Quote, "It is very rare for people not to know someone who knows about people being killed. But there doesn't appear to be anything to support allegations of mass killings," he said. "It is generally paramilitaries who are responsible. It doesn't seem organized. There appear to be individual acts of sadism rather than anything else. There seems not to be any policy or instruction, but that isn't to say that people have not been given the latitude to kill. However, I don't think at this stage we have anything that adds up to the systematic killing of civilians," unquote. Ward believes that those who stayed longer in Kosovo have been subjected to more violence, that many have been terrorized because they have stayed so long. Many have fled terror, but some of those Ward spoke to said they were fleeing the NATO bombs. Quote, "The Serbs didn't touch us until NATO attacked," unquote, Kosovar told him. Skipping down, "Watching the television images and listening to the newscasters thunder about further reports of Serb massacres and of genocide, I feel uneasy about saying that they have very little to go on. Yet almost every newspaper journalist I spoke to privately in Macedonia felt the same way. The story being seen at home is different from the one that appeared to be happening on the ground. Maybe the truth here is not one thing, but I don't want to be accomplice to a lie. I don't want to bellow for my life or for theirs, yet there's something not right in this easy way with detail. It is a surreal place, Macedonia, and it was this aspect to which a friend of mine drew attention when I got home. Nobody much wants to return to Jean Cocteau, but there was something soothing in the words my friend quoted. History is a combination of reality and lies, he said. The reality of history becomes a lie. The reality of the fable becomes the truth. So how much actual truth and how much fable is contained in the reports that are coming out of Kosovo at this point, I think is anybody's guess. A very significant article which could portend that the euro will turn out to be a weak currency because many of the European countries that are members of the European Monetary Union will not be able to adhere to the strict budgetary restrictions required for participation in that European Monetary Union. Indications of the first significant fissure in the foundation of the European Monetary Union were carried in the Financial Times of Wednesday, May 26th of 1999. While this does not necessarily portend doom for the EMU, it certainly is not a development that is being welcomed by the leaders of that organization, and it's one that could portend the easing of budgetary restrictions on the member countries of the EMU. That, in turn, could lead to the weak euro that originally was forecast in some of the analysis that I presented on the coming of the European Monetary Union. The following, again, is from the Financial Times of London of Wednesday, May 26th of 1999. This is by Peter Norman in Brussels, and it's headlined, Cracks Appear in Euro Pact with Italian Deal. The first cracks in the economic stability pact that underpins the euro opened up yesterday when Giuliano Amato, Italy's newly appointed Treasury Minister, forced European Union colleagues to change this country's budget deficit target. In a move that privately appalled European Commission officials, the finance ministers agreed to allow Italy to overshoot a budget deficit target of 2% of gross domestic product this year in the event of a serious economic downturn. They gave Italy leeway to increase its 1999 deficit to 2.4% of GDP. Yesterday's decision to give ground raised fears that the EU system of peer group pressure, unquote, and stability programs to discipline member states may be failing within 6 months of the euro's launch in January. It comes after both the Commission and the European Central Bank expressed worries that other large euro member states, such as Germany and France, have been less than rigorous in pursuing deficit targets. So again, a potentially very significant article indicating the possibility of a weak euro. Bear in mind that the European Monetary Union is a realization of the pan-Germanic theories of Friedrich Liszt, who proposed in the 1840s a pan-European economic union dominated by Germany as a vehicle for Germany unseating Great Britain as the dominant power on Earth. Well, that plan is now going into effect. However, the dominant power that they figured to replace is the United States. I would note, too, that the European economy has, to a considerable extent, already been subsumed by Germany as a result of a combination of political and economic maneuvering during and between the two world wars. In particular, the Second World War resulted to a large extent with the German consolidation of European economic assets under its tent. That's discussed in a pair of half-hour segments entitled, appropriately enough, German Domination of the European Economy. This is not good news that Italy has been allowed to exceed its limitations. If other countries do the same, again, it could result in a very weak euro, which in turn could result in a serious downturn for American manufactured exports. It would be a very, very serious development indeed. There has been other discussion of the European Monetary Union in numerous other segments as well, including a discussion of the Friedrich Liszt analysis of what it would take to bring world domination by Germany. And again, in my opinion, the European Monetary Union is essentially the realization of that plan by Liszt. The various tapes that I've alluded to are available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire. That's spelled S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E, one word. They can be located by mail at P.O. Box 1179. That's P.O. Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. The email address for Spitfire is spitfire@ix.netcom.com. Once again, that's spitfire at ix.netcom.com. There's a list of and description of the various tapes available from Spitfire on the Spitfire webpage. That's at www.spitfirelist.com. Spitfire List is one word. Once again, www.spitfirelist.com. Please note that the Spitfire website is equipped with real audio, so you can listen to the segments that are going out to the various stations that carry the program on the Spitfire website. People who do not have access to the web, by the way, can contact Spitfire for a list of the various programs that they carry. I would note, too, that the KFJC webpage also carries a list of tapes available from Spitfire, along with price information, etc. The KFJC webpage is at www.kfjc.org. That's www.kfjc.org. Look in the transmission section and public affairs. The KFJC website is also equipped with audio so that people can listen to the longer program that I do from 7 to 10 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on my home base station in California. That program is called One Step Beyond It. Again, it's on 7 to 10 p.m. on Sunday night. Pacific Standard Time, it also is partially rebroadcast Thursday evening, 6 to 7 p.m. on Thursday. That concludes this segment. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.